2:30 in the afternoon. We're here in the State Capitol building. This is the time and place that was noticed for this meeting. I'm Dusty Johnson. My colleagues, Commissioners Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen, are here. And before we get started with the formal agenda, we do have a recognition to do. We've got the manager of our grain warehouse division, Mr. Jim Melhoff, who has managed to spend 15 years in the employ of state government and done a very good job. And I think, of course, all of us have always appreciated Jim, but particularly in the last year when there have been lots of stressful times in the grain industry and lots of tough questions put to the Public Utilities Commission and are we doing the right thing for producers and having the right regulatory regime. And it makes us feel good to have Jim and his team taking care of business down there. So perhaps we can give Jim a round of applause as we present him with his 15-year pin. Jim's band requested an opportunity to play a song, but we've turned him down. So, with that, we'll go to the first item on our formal agenda, which is consumer reports, and that's a status update from Ms. Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 108 contacts since the last report was prepared for the February 10th, 2009 Commission meeting. 58 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 16 of the contacts involved electric service, 5 contacts involved natural gas service, 2 contacts involved gas and electric service, 5 contacts involved cell phone service, 9 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, and 13 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 335 of the 382 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved, and 2,505 of the 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Gregg? All right, hearing none, I think CT08-002 is actually noticed for the end of the meeting, and since that may be slightly more time-consuming, I think we probably will hold that to the end. With that, we'll proceed to electric item number one, which is EL09-001. This deals with the filing that Otter Tail Power made for approval to update certain rates. The question for the Commission today is, shall the Commission grant Otter Tail Power's motion to withdraw and, as a result, close the docket? We'll look to the moving party and Otter Tail for any comments they may have.
Mr. Chairman Johnson, I don't believe they're on the phone today.
Sounds good. Mr. Jacobson, go ahead, proceed.
Thank you. Otter Tail has requested to withdraw this filing until a later time, probably after the rate case is completed.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks very much. Any questions by commissioners or advisors? Commissioner Kolbeck.
If we do decide to dismiss this, when would the when would it be dealt with? Would it be dealt with over the rate case, or would it be dealt with even after that?
Probably
time frame?
Probably after the rate case, I would guess, at this point.
I realize it's not a lot of money, but could it be possibly a year or maybe 6 months from now?
No, I would think from what I've, going from memory, what they said, it'd be shortly after the rate case. And the rate case is scheduled to conclude probably in April or May of this year. So midsummer, I would think they'd probably come back.
Okay. Thank you.
So help me understand the efficiencies gained by doing it after a rate case as opposed to now.
Well, the problem in this case is that their cogeneration rates rely on a marginal cost analysis. That is also being looked at in the rate case. And so to make a decision on this docket prior to the rate case doesn't really fit in. We'll probably have testimony and a witness on the marginal cost study. And so we would like to at least take care of that in a rate case part of it before we approve it or recommend any changes in this particular proceeding.
So there are at least two issues to play that come to mind then. First off is it would be odd for the commission to decide this month that marginal cost is something, you know, approximated by this number and then find something perhaps very different shortly thereafter. And then secondly, to the extent that we want and Otter Tail Power wants these rates to be accurate, even if the commission approved rate X, that may have to be updated some relatively short number of months afterwards once we have a better feel for what that is. So rather than do it twice, let's do it once and get it right. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I think our main concern is we don't want to set a precedent by approving something now that we may regret later.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Commissioner, this is Greg Rissel. I just wanted to point out the fact that this rate hasn't been revised for a long time, and the idea that it would change twice in just a matter of a few months, as a general rule, we try to avoid confusion, and I think the confusion that would arise because of this would be prevalent. I think it's better to wait for the reasons you just mentioned. I think it's a good idea, and it should lessen customer confusion.
Other questions? Any commissioner comments or action?
A motion in EL09-001 that the commission grant the motion to withdraw and close the docket.
Okay, motion has been made. No second is required. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Perhaps we'll also move Electric 2 toward the bottom because that may take a little bit more time. And given the shortness of the agenda, I don't think that'll be any burden on Black Hills Power. So move to Telecom Item Number 1, which deals with the petition filed by Mid-Continent Communications for approval of its switched access rates. Specifically, the question before the Commission today is, shall it grant a petition for reconsideration? And secondarily, if the petition is granted, how shall the Commission proceed? This time we'll look toward Mid-Continent Communications to add anything to their brief.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications in this proceeding. Our petition for reconsideration was rather short and to the point, and I think that the points made are the points that we believe are most important, and I needn't go over them again for you. I will say, however, that I apologize to staff and to the commission, and staff is absolutely right in pointing out that a cost study was not filed with the original filing on October 31st, 2007. We had met earlier with staff and had delivered an earlier version of the cost study, and I apologize, I've got a cold, excuse me. And I was operating from a timeline that I had, and I just dictated the wrong word as far as tariff or cost study when I dictated the brief, and I apologize for that. Nonetheless, we stand by our position that Commission staff knew that a cost study was being worked on, and that there was ample time for the staff to review it had they gotten to it. We believe that fair is fair, and given the fact that Mid-Continent went to considerable time and effort to perform a cost study, which was known to staff, and we believe at least we were being encouraged to do so, that at the very least, if the Commission wishes that staff have more time to review the cost study, that the Commission give serious consideration to permitting the rate to go into effect now, subject to refund, as we have indicated in our brief, or excuse me, in our petition. I will also say the filing that was required by the Commission in its order will likely be made either tomorrow or the next day. Mary Lonis was here yesterday, and we worked on the tariff that the Commission's order requires us to file. And the cost study, of course, is already on file. It was filed in the main proceeding, and so that is on file. And so what I'll do is file a petition with the tariff on it and making reference to the cost study that's on file. So with that, unless there are questions, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I don't plan on talking any longer. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Gerdes, and we'll hold questions until after we've heard the other comments. Turn toward staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Staff would submit that Mid-Continent's petition for reconsideration should be denied. There are two reasons for this. The first is Mid-Continent's failure to state a legal ground for reconsideration, and the second is because it is not in the public interest to grant reconsideration. ARSD 2010-01-30.1 states that the petitioner must notify the commission of the error claimed and must direct the commission to a particular finding of fact or conclusion of law or ruling or action asserted to be erroneous in the legal basis for the relief of the request. Staff would submit that the petitioner did not state a legal ground for reconsideration. Just because Mid-Continent is unhappy with the result, that in and of itself does not translate into a legal ground for reconsideration. Petitioner alluded to fundamental fairness. That argument has no merit, as was pointed out by staff in its post-hearing brief filed on October 31, 2008. I could reread that to you, but I will pass at this time if you have questions regarding that argument of fundamental fairness. I would be happy to address that. Basically, bottom line is Mid-Continent failed to articulate the statute, the type of classification, whether it be sex, race, age, alienage, or national origin, or which test was violated, whether it be rational basis or strictly scrutinized. The argument has no merit. Finally, the petition should be denied because the cost study rate that Mid-Continent wants the commission to implement is nothing more than a guess, and a guess could never be in the public interest. The reason the switched access rate is a guess is because, as pointed out by Mid-Continent in Mr. Fisher's testimony, they used estimates when developing allocation factors. And Mid-Continent acknowledges it did not have a readily available cost of capital analysis to support a rate of return, so they guessed at that also. They also noted that QSI's efforts to come up with a switched access rate, in coming up with a switched access rate, that they used numerous approximations and broad gauge allocation methods. And finally, they noted that allocations such as a DEM weighting analysis wasn't even conducted because it was infeasible. All of those factors and others in their testimony at the hearing prove that the cost study was incomplete, it did not follow commission rules, it is unreviewed, and therefore the switched access rate produced is really no better than a guess. The commission's ruling was sound, and therefore the petition for reconsideration should be denied, as there is not a legal ground established for reconsideration, and it is not in the public interest to grant reconsideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. Commissioner Advisor, questions?
May I respond?
Rebuttal, Mr. Gerdes. Go ahead.
excuse me. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, first of all, we disagree with staff and believe that we do, in fact, have a legal ground. If you look at 2010-01-30.01, the last ground is, or upon consequences resulting from compliance with the decision or order. And the consequences of complying with this decision or order are legally in question because the cost study that was filed stood without criticism or without detailed comment by staff, and they simply say, no, we didn't have enough time to review it. They didn't give any specific reasons during the hearing. And then secondly, as it relates to Ms. Kramer's reference that the the cat cost study should not be considered further. The commission's own order says that Mid-Continent shall be required to file a cost study based proposed rates, and that staff is directed to perform a thorough evaluation of the study. So unless the commission is going to reverse its own order, what Ms. Kramer points out does not stand as part of the relief afforded in this proceeding. This proceeding is simply whether or not the commission should reconsider whether or not to permit Mid-Continent to charge its rate subject to refund. Thank you. Excuse me.
Thanks, Mr. Gerdes. Commissioner questions, advisor questions. Commissioner Kolbeck, go ahead.
I have one. To enact these rates, when we need a tariff, have you filed a tariff?
That's what I referred to, Commissioner Kolbeck, yeah. That it will be filed tomorrow. The order requires us to file a tariff, and we will do so. As I said, Mary Lonis and I worked on it yesterday, and it'll be filed.
And that's what I was a little confused on. Do you, Mr. Gerdes, do you think that these estimates will ever go away if staff and Mid-Continent could come to an agreement on how to use integrate GAAP accounting and USOC or USOA accounting, I should say?
I didn't understand the first part of your question. What will go away?
Basically, right now, we've got two different types of accounting, correct? One cost study filed, and the cost study that was filed tried to make GAAP accounting work into USOA accounting, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So the estimates that your witness had testified to, do you ever feel that that will ever be mediated, or will they always be estimates?
I have to rely on Mr. Fisher's testimony during the hearing, and my recollection was that the response to that would be is that we're simply talking about numbers, and the conversion of the GAAP accounting numbers to the USOA numbers is simply a matter of assigning costs that were categorized in one way under GAAP accounting to comparable buckets under USOA accounting. So my answer to you, I believe, is that procedure should work because that's what they're doing.
And you're confident that with the staff's help and Mid-Continent and Mr. Fisher maybe or whoever you choose, that cost study could become a valuable product in the end?
Certainly, because the commission's order approves it as well, because the commission's order is that staff is supposed to go ahead with this rulemaking, and the rulemaking will undoubtedly have to deal with this same very issue.
Well,
there will eventually be rules that will likely mirror the procedure that was used by QSI, I would say.
Well, and I just wanted to make sure that everyone was still on the same page as to how this was supposed to move forward. So that's it. Mr. Chairman?
Yes? Okay, thanks very much. You know, when we're both Mr. Smith and I are digging for it, but Mr. Gerdes, you know, there's something in rule, that makes it pretty clear that switched access rate that this commission sets can't allow for any over recovery of costs. And I know that, you have argued and your client has argued that, this rate, this is a reasonable cost study. And then I think if you don't use the phrase should be given some deference, in your pleading, I think you said something about that it should be, the commission should rely on that in the interim.
Yes.
Do you really think that the hearing we had a few months ago tested that study enough to where the commission could rely on that as any sort of a reasonable interim rate?
Mr. Chairman, I have to answer that this way. We had been working with staff on the concept of a cost study for a long time, not just that 6 months from the time this proceeding was filed until the commission reached a decision. the very reason that you have in statute and in rule the ability to award a rate, then review it, and then order a refund if the rate was somehow incorrect, begs the question of whether or not the rate that this should be denied because it's over recovering. We don't know whether it's over recovering until after the proceeding has gone on. Again, I go back to what we said during the hearing, Mr. Chairman, and that is that Mid-Continent came forward with testimony and a cost study based upon notice. If staff wasn't ready to go to hearing, they could have asked for a continuance. They did not. They chose to go forward with that hearing, and therefore they must accept what happened at that hearing and accept the evidence as it stands. And I would submit that the evidence as it stands supports the accuracy of the cost study, because basically all staff did was say they didn't have enough time to look at it.
Well, and you know, I'll opine a little bit in here, Mr. Gerdes, and give you an opportunity to respond. But I mean, I wonder if that landscape you describe isn't true when you've got, you know, two parties to a case that are both, you know, in the private sector. But when you've got, a staff situation, I mean, it's not staff that's injured if the commission makes a bad decision. It's the public interest. And I just wonder, I mean, let's set staff aside for a minute, because I think, you know, reasonable minds can disagree about whether staff should have done X or staff should have done Y. But let's turn our finger of blame or assignment directly onto the commission. I mean, I now wonder, I mean, as you ask the commission to set, you know, this cost study as the interim rate, I really wonder if the commission shouldn't have dove into those numbers a little bit more. I mean, forget what staff wanted to do. Shouldn't the commission have tested those numbers, and shouldn't the hearing have gone a little longer, and shouldn't we have dove in, and shouldn't that have felt more like a full-blown rate case? So let's presume for a minute that this commission, or at least this commissioner, didn't ask all the questions that should have been asked. I don't think that means that in the interim, Mid-Continent just gets the rate that it wants. I mean, at some point, we've got to try to figure out in the interim what's in the public interest, regardless of whether or not these three commissioners asked all the questions they should have asked a few months ago. And I'll give you an opportunity to respond.
Well, Commissioner, my response to that is that the public interest is served by the mechanism of ordering a refund if we were wrong. That's why it's there. I mean, there has to be some finality to things. Go into a regular court. You have a jury trial. And when you get down to the end, the jury makes a decision based upon the evidence in front of them. They can't say, well, gee, we wish we had some more evidence. I mean, that's what due process is. Each side gets a chance to tell their story to the fact finder and the decision maker, and then the decision maker makes a decision based upon that evidence.
Well, with all due respect.
It may be we wish there were more evidence, but nonetheless, there has to be some finality somewhere.
Well, with all due respect, though, Mr. Gerdes, we're not talking about a final disposition. I mean, we're talking about an interim rate.
Right, but we have to get to that point before we can go any further.
Right, and I think a reasonable default could be the rate that is currently in place. I mean, if you just feel like a burden hasn't been met, that should be the new interim rate, then I think one reasonable approach could be the approaches that Commissioner Hansen and Colbeck took on this interim rate question.
Well, my response to that, Commissioner, is this, and it goes down to the way that the hearing was conducted again, and that is that we put on evidence that I would submit was a prima facie case to support that cost study. Now, if the commission believes that staff carried its burden and proved otherwise from the testimony that's in the record, then I would agree with you. We submit that staff's testimony did not carry that burden, and therefore that the interim rate should be charged until the cost study is reviewed.
We'll look to Commissioner Hansen for his questions, comments.
As you may have seen me moving towards the microphone, I was just going to emphasize the point that you already made, that if we are, in fact, talking about that there needs to be some finality to even an interim position that the commission has, in fact, similarly to that jury example, has taken that position, albeit a split decision. The fact is that we arrived at a conclusion, and if there's a finality that I felt was a finality. I don't find fault with staff either. I believe that staff did their job. I appreciate the information I received. And as I examine this, frankly, to an extent, I will admit I felt I was doing you folks a favor by, and I know you won't appreciate that by the way I voted, but when I look at it from the other angle, I would say that we could, for me personally, to arrive at a perfectly comfortable position would have required your client to move to a different accounting system. To me, in order to balance that out, you'd have to go to the USOA and provide that information to us so I could balance it out in my own mind. We can go into entirely different arguments at this juncture, but so that you know what was in the dark recesses of my mind at the time that I was attempting to arrive at a conclusion here, those are things that I was considering. I think we have a lot of different options at this point with this item before us at this time, but I don't intend to change my position at this time.
If I may, Commissioner, just I believe that what QSI did was convert to a different accounting system, and it did, in fact, convert the numbers from GAAP to USOA. That's what I would say in response to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions, commissioners or advisors?
Commissioner, if I could ask, this is Greg Russell again. I recall sitting in this room and talking about a cooperative effort to go over the cost study post-hearing. This was a couple of months ago, maybe, perhaps. But the question I'd have would be of staff, and, has anything been done? And if not, why not since that time?
Done about what?
As far as working on the cost study, as far as vetting the cost study.
We have contacted different consultants and have run into a couple of issues, one of which is it's tax season. The other is in talking to a couple of the consultants, their concern is that if they work on the USOC accounts, that usually means their clients are a competitor of Mid-Continent's, and they just don't believe that Mid-Continent is ever going to release financial information to them to do the review. The other thing I've heard in talking to them is the amount of money this review will take. They're talking maybe bifurcate it in some manner, but they do not believe it to be an inexpensive proposition. And quite frankly, we haven't found anybody who's I'm sure there are plenty of consultants out there who'd be more than happy to step up and do this for a boatload of money. But I haven't really been able to find one who's willing to do it, who thinks, that they can get to what we're after. But again, it's going to cost a lot of money. And I want to make sure people understand, this is not a thousands of dollars review. This will be a much bigger review than that, is what I'm being told. So that, I've gone that far. I have met with Mr. Smith on the rules. I'm not sure if he got those done last week or not. I think it was going to be later this week. But those should be routed within, around the staff and that hopefully yet this week, early next week, and then put out for public comment shortly thereafter. So I think there's going to be rules in place long before this review is completed.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? Ms. Kramer?
Well, I just wanted to point out one thing, maybe. When Mr. Gerdes cited to the Rule 30.1 regarding having consequences resulting from compliance, the whole sentence in that is an application for rehearing or reconsideration based on newly discovered evidence, which this is not. So I just wanted to correct that. I believe the rule you're looking for is ARSD, Chairman Johnson, is ARSD 2010-2706, or it might possibly be, I'm not sure what you're looking for, SDCL 49-31-4 were the ones that I have cited.
Thanks, and Mr. Smith also found that for me. About 30 seconds after I started talking, so my timing was off of that. Comments or action by commissioners?
I just have a comment, maybe a question for Mr. Smith. And if we were to deny the request, could you lay out what would happen if we denied the request or if we approved his request for reconsideration? Just kind of give us the lowdown on that.
Well, I think if you deny the request, things stay the way they are under the order that we issued. That would leave Midco at this point subject to its current, it would be subject to its current rate, which is, I believe it's the existing Quest rate. The specific relief that Mr. Gerdes requested in his request for reconsideration was just with respect to the interim rate decision, okay? And that would be if you were to grant the request that they have made, what would happen is you would in effect have a different decision on Commissioner Johnson's motion the last time we heard this, and you would end up with the rate that their cost study supports, which is 9.85 cents. That's the rate.
Confidential?
What, pardon me?
Is that confidential?
No, it's not confidential. It's not. I checked. There were 16 references to it in the transcript without invoking confidential. So, no, and it as a filed rate, I mean, it can't be confidential anyway. And I mean, you know, if you deny, yes, the existing rate that they have will remain in effect. And the other provisions of the order will, unless Midco takes some other interim action, you know, or appeals or whatever, will lead to the other things in there, which is Midco filing a formal rate filing, a formal tariff filing with the rate that it wants, and its cost study, which I agree is already on file as an exhibit in a hearing, but Mr. Gerdes said that will be referenced then as a supporting cost study rather than what Midco originally requested, which was an exemption from the requirement of having to file a cost study. And we will then proceed with the order's admonition to expeditiously evaluate the cost study, and we'll have to bring it back for hearing if that's necessary.
And the interim rate currently is what's known as the Quest rate, and that number is 6.
I can't remember the precise number here. It is
0.642, something like that. Yeah.
Six and 0.4 cents, something along in there.
And so that if the commission were to deny the motion, that's the rate that would stay in place at least in the interim.
Yes.
Other questions, comments, or any action?
I haven't seen too much more that would change my mind on the first way I voted, so I'm in a motion. I understand Mr. Gerdes' arguments, but I also understand Ms. Kramer's arguments. So this is, and Mr. Gerdes actually said that they have been working towards trying to put these two together. So I guess I don't know why we would change the course of what we had voted on in the middle of the stream here. So in TC07-117, I'll motion to deny the Mid-Continent's petition to reconsider.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? I'll just add, you know, more for consistency's sake than anything. Of course, that's the hobgoblin of little minds, but more than for consistency than anything, I think I'll oppose your motion, Commissioner Colbeck. But that being said, I don't think the commission made any great error when it voted the way that it did. I certainly think it's very defensible. I'm frankly less comfortable with the cost study rate now than I was a few weeks ago. The more I think about it, I mean, I know the refund is supposed to sort of hold companies harmless, but at some point in this sort of an economic environment, there is an opportunity cost to that money that a company gets to hold on to. There is, you know, an interest, I mean, a carrying charge attempts to make up for that, but I don't know how good a job it does. And then when you've got companies potentially with cash flow issues, they'd probably rather hold on to their own money rather than pay it in and have it returned later. That being said, I do think the refund provision tries to mitigate some of those concerns, and just wanted to make that clear. Other comments on the pending motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I will be supporting the motion, but I have been trying to figure out some middle ground as I'm going through this process, and I'm assuming that other commissioners have as well. And trying to figure out some way whether there could be an interim. I'm just stuck in a position where I don't believe that there's any good way to come up with an interim number right now. And in any direction that I turn to try to come up with the refunding process, which has been done in the past, I just can't come up with a methodology of a middle ground that I'm comfortable with. And so I will be supporting the motion.
Other comments on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes nay. The motion carries 2-1, and so Mid-Continent's petition for reconsideration is denied. Thanks very much to everyone. With that, I will proceed to telecommunications item number 2. That's in the matter of the filing of an approval for an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest and McLeod. The question for the commission today is, shall it approve that amendment? Look toward either of the parties to make any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is George Thompson from Quest. I'll just mention for the commission's edification that TC09-002 and TC09-003, the next item on the agenda, are very routine filings for agreed interconnection agreements between Quest and McLeod on the one hand and Quest and BLC management on the other.
Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Semler.
Thank you. I agree and will give my routine little spiel. That they were properly filed and executed do not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Thanks very much. Any questions on TC09-002? Hearing none, we'll move to action, and I will move the commission approve the amendment to the agreement. Hearing no discussion on the motion, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Proceed to telecom number item number 2, which is for the approval of an interconnection agreement between Quest and BLC management. Today, shall the commission approve that interconnection agreement? We've already heard from Quest. Ms. Semler.
Again, I agree that the amendment was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I move that the commission approve the interconnection agreement.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll move back toward the top of our agenda, consumer complaint item number 1, CT08-002. This deals with a complaint filed by Mr. Roger Hall against Quest Corporation regarding the cost of telephone line extensions. Quest did file a motion for summary disposition, and that is what is on the commission's plate today. We have had filings, but we'll look to Mr. Thompson or others from Quest to make any oral comments.
Thank you.
I'm Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I think we need to do Black Hills first. The Roger Hall was noticed to be after the regularly scheduled.
No, I think that's right. Good job. And I'm sure Black Hills Power wouldn't disagree. So just in complete legal consistency, if it was noticed after the meeting, then we'll go ahead and hold action on that. Instead, proceed to electricity item number 2, which is in the matter of the application of Black Hills Power for approval of an electric cost adjustment, and that's before the commission today. Black Hills Power.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Brian Iverson. I'm Vice President of Electric Regulatory Services for Black Hills Power. We're here today to talk about the ECA. I've brought with me Chris Kilpatrick, who's the Director of Rates for the company. I'll turn it over to him.
Thanks, Brian. I would like to start with a brief background on Black Hills Power's Energy Cost Adjustment, or ECA. This is our second filing under the current ECA methodology. The filing is based on actual 2008 costs with no 2009 forecast energy costs. The ECA has three components: a transmission cost adjustment, a steam plant fuel cost adjustment, and the conditional energy cost adjustment. The transmission energy adjustment is the cost to move our generation to our customers. The steam plant adjustment is the cost of fuel and fuel handling for our coal plants, and the conditional energy cost adjustment represents the cost of purchased energy and natural gas costs for our CTs. The transmission adjustment is for approximately 0.020 cents per kilowatt hour, or around $300,000 in total. This increase is primarily due to the building of new transmission lines for our common use transmission system. The steam plant adjustment is for approximately 0.164 cents per kilowatt hour, or around $2.4 million in total. That increase is primarily driven by the higher costs to mine coal in our coal plant, in our coal mine. For example, one significant cost increase was the cost of diesel fuel during 2008, during the energy crisis, when it was around $4 or $4.50 per gallon of diesel. And with all the huge mining equipment, that adds up to a significant cost. And the final piece of the ECA is the conditional energy cost adjustment for approximately 0.143 cents per kilowatt hour, or around $2.1 million. And the main driver for this cost increase is the higher purchase power costs during this past summer during the energy crisis, and the higher natural gas costs to burn in our combustion turbines. As you've seen in our filing, our overall cost of service increase is approximately $6.5 million, and we are requesting a recovery of approximately $4.4 million. The reason for the lower request relates to our conditional energy cost adjustment and the sharing mechanism that we have in place with that. And as a percentage, Black Hills Power has absorbed approximately 35% of the total cost of service increase instead of passing that along to our customers. At this point, I'd like to open it up for any questions.
Before we take questions, we'll look to staff for their comments.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Bob Canale with Commission staff. I think Chris did a fairly good job of explaining the proposal. Staff would recommend approval with an effective date of March 1st as proposed by the company, and staff would be happy to answer any questions. And what this would amount to for an average residential customer, which uses about 620 kWh, is $1.69 over the existing ECA. And another example would be for if you use 1,000 kWh, it would be an increase of about $2.73 over the current energy cost adjustment. And it is, you know, all the calculations are made in accordance with the tariff and their statement, our calculation for their affiliate coal plants.
Thanks very much. Questions from commissioners or advisors?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Mr. Knadel, or perhaps Chris, you could answer this. What is the percentage then of an increase over the entire, what would this amount to as an average residential increase? I know average on a summer is different than an average in a winter, so.
It is.
And we're talking about one piece of the few of the bill as opposed to the entire bill, but I'm just curious from a residence's standpoint, they're always interested in how is this going to affect me?
I didn't calculate the actual on an actual bill, I guess, as far as 620 kWh. I don't know if Chris has the information. I don't have a copy of the tariff that I could do that quick.
Are you telling us that the average for the average homeowner, they're going to be looking at approximately $1.70 increase per month?
For 620 kWh, correct.
On an average month, okay.
Right. Yeah, I think it's right around 4-4.5% increase.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I'm going to follow up on that a little bit because the filing talks about a 5.7% increase, but that really is on the cost of service. And then to your point, Mr. Patrick, you do have sort of an offset, if I can call it that. Some of those costs are borne by Black Hills Power. And so the resulting rate, I think, I would be interested in that because I think that's the right question. 5.7 isn't really the number that affects consumers. It's something that might be in that 4-4.5% range you asked about. So if you manage to stumble across that while we're talking, that would be good to know. Other questions? Commissioner Colbert? Okay. I have maybe a couple. My hope would be that this is going to look in hindsight like a spike, given some of the hopefully isolated things you're talking about. I mean, I hope $4 diesel isn't, going to be around in 2009 to any great extent. As well as unscheduled maintenance, outages rather. Can you give me an idea of what we have seen in 2009 so far and what that may indicate to us this rate might look like in a year? I mean, is this a spike or is this a new normal?
Yeah, it's hard to say for sure exactly what prices are going to do. An example right now is power prices for the summer are around maybe $70-$75 per megawatt hour, when last summer they were running around $100 a megawatt hour. So it's nice to see that decrease. However, there is a lot of construction right now in the transmission arena, so that cost adjustment will probably trend upward as we see additional facilities being built. And in our coal mine, it's hard to determine exactly what's going to happen there. But again, hopefully we would like to see or hope that that's going to kind of be a little bit more steady and not be such a spike.
So specifically, and staff maybe had access to this through a discovery process and, the commissioners wouldn't have had access to that. And so I was hoping to get a little more detail about each of these three main areas and what caused the increases. So if we could just start with the CECA, and you talked about unscheduled extended maintenance. Can you give me an idea of what caused that? How long are we talking? What sort of a cost impact that specifically had, and whether or not anything's being done to minimize the likelihood of that happening in the future?
Sure. It was one of our coal facilities went down for a scheduled maintenance in, I believe, April of last year, and upon the scheduled maintenance found additional issues with the coal plant. And since it was down in the month of April, which is kind of a shoulder month and the demand isn't as high, we extended that outage for approximately 30 days. So to replace the usage or the output from that coal plant, we had to go and buy additional purchase power, which from a variable rate perspective, a coal plant is around $15 or $20 per megawatt hour on a variable cost. And when you're purchasing power, it's even in April, it's probably going to average around $40 per megawatt hour. So that was an item that would have increased in the conditional energy cost adjustment, the cost associated with that. We do believe with that extended outage, though, it will mitigate any future outages since we did take it down for an additional 30 days during that time period.
And I don't want to get into a whole big IRP proceeding here. But, I mean, were there other mechanisms? I mean, I think you mentioned something like a new peak, something like 9 or 10 times during the winter. I mean, long-term, are there demand response mechanisms, or are there other things that Black Hills Power is doing to try to shave those peaks a bit?
Yeah, we have demand-side management programs out there. We have a demand controller program that will help offset some of those. I know in December of this year it was extraordinarily cold. We exceeded, I think, our peak by almost 40 megawatts from our previous, which is a significant increase on a 400-megawatt system. So it's a 10% increase in our max. The one thing that we are hopefully going to do to help mitigate some of these spikes is we are in the process of building YGen 3, a new baseload coal facility. And with that, again, we will have a lot less reliance on purchase power costs, which are much more expensive than on a variable pricing perspective to our baseload.
So, of course, you know, YGen 3 is baseload. I mean, does that help the peaking scenario because you shove natural gas plants that maybe are serving an intermediate function more into peaking? Or, I mean, how does the addition of that plant help you on the margins on those peak days?
It does. It leads you to less exposure to your purchase power and also your CTs for your combustion turbines. You know, anywhere between 75 or 100 megawatts on every hour will be used from a baseload facility instead of going out and buying purchase power when, again, a purchase power on average cost in December was probably around $65 or $70 per megawatt hour. And on a variable cost basis for your coal plant, it's anywhere between $10 and $15 per megawatt hour.
So aside from YGen 3, I mean, are there other things that Black Hills Power is looking into? I mean, I just think this is notable because it's sort of sizable, particularly when you look at a percentage basis. It's a big hit. Now, this is a little unfair for you guys. I mean, a lot of the, you know, fuel adjustment clauses we see just sort of, they come by. I mean, every month they're adjusting, they're more fluid. We don't have quite the same opportunity to have this dialogue. So it's a little unfair to, you know, ask you some of these questions. But, I mean, are there other things that, I mean, this is a pretty big spike. Are there things that Black Hills Power is doing other than YGen 3 to help minimize the likelihood that we're here next year doing the exact same thing?
Well, we're working with our customers, trying to educate them, trying to move people to use off-peak, in essence. You know, I think with even with YGen 3 coming online and doing some rate design, we're going to be working to help educate our customers with that as well and maybe figure out a way to push costs outside of the peak time during the day. But other than that, those are the most of the things that I can think of at this point.
And I don't need an exact number. I mean, give me a ballpark figure. I mean, of the CECA, the increase, I mean, if it's two big pots of, you know, purchase power was more expensive and then you all CT, running those more often is more expensive. Can you give me an idea of where the proportion of where the cost increase came from?
Yeah, the majority is for purchase power.
Okay.
And most of the time, the spread between buying purchase power and actually running your combustion turbines are very close because you have to add transportation on top of your gas costs, so it makes it sometimes less advantageous to actually run your CTs. There are times that you have to for load support
sure.
in the certain load areas, but in general, purchase power seems to be more economical.
Okay. Commissioner Colbeck, you had a question?
Oh, I just... Are you finished?
I'm not, but go ahead and you know me if you don't interrupt me. I mean, if I get a head of steam up, it might be a while, so go ahead.
Well, actually, with some of my questions actually did pertain to the peak. Do you know how much more of your base load grew? You talk about a 40-megawatt peak, but over the course of the year, do you know how much more your base load had increased?
I do not offhand, no. We can certainly obviously research that and get back to you.
Okay. And that 40 megawatt is a winter peak. Was
the winter
it wasn't
peak,
an
yes.
overall peak, but it was a winter peak.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess I was more – I was wondering how much of your normal operating instead of the peak, how much that increased from year to year. But my second question is to the customers. I'm looking at something that was – is it your Exhibit 7? Okay, that actually mentions like $1.92 per month. Where do you sit with your customers right now as far as notification of this process? Are they still expecting a $1.92 increase, or have you sent out anything since?
We did post the updated amount when we did do our amended application. We posted them all in our district offices, They will be put into our customer billing notice, and with our key accounts, we are working with them through February and March, going down and seeing with them personally.
Okay. And when will they see this? If this is approved, when would they see this in their June bill?
They would actually start seeing it in March. It would be for services provided after March 1, so we have cycle billing, so it will be prorated through March and then probably a full month impact in the month of April.
Okay. But they are, all of your customers are aware and did receive the heads up that something's coming down.
We haven't mailed them all out, no, not at this point, but they will be hopefully after these get approved. But those have all been posted in all of our district offices for
okay.
people to,
okay.
to review.
Okay. Thank you.
So turning toward the transmission cost adjustment piece of it, you talk about the increase there coming from primarily two things. Number one, an increase in base and electric rates for the common use transmission system, and then secondly, you know, WAPA's ancillary services rate. Can you talk to me a little bit about what is the financial impact of each of those? And, I mean, were those sort of typical inflationary increases, or were there some large changes going on in either of those organizations causing the increase, and how likely are similar increases in the future?
Sure. With WAPA, it's just kind of a cost of service pass-through. Their costs are continuing to go up, and they're passing that along to us. So
and how big was that?
I don't recall offhand. I think it was a couple $100,000 in total to Black Hills Power.
Give me some context. I mean, are we talking, I mean, is cost of service 2 or 3% sort of an inflationary type adjustment, or was it significant beyond that?
I believe as a percentage, it was approximately 7% of their costs previously. And then the bigger piece is the base and electric, and that really relates to building transmission facilities for the common use system. They are in for a rate case right now with the FERC, and it's an interim rate at this point in time that is put into service, and then that will be finalized with FERC through doing a formal rate case. But they're putting in significant facilities for the transmission system.
And so, I mean, if 7% is, you know, a WAPA, you know, typical cost of service increase, then we would, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised if we hear something like that next year and the year after that and the year after that.
I would say so for the WAPA, but the big piece in 2009 is going to be the expansion of the facilities. There is significant capital dollars being spent in the transmission facility area, so there are going to be higher costs associated with that.
Yeah, a good reminder for us. I mean, we clamor for additional transmission as much as anybody. Maybe more. This is a good reminder that, you know, that bill gets picked up by somebody and not necessarily those people who are benefiting even indirectly from whatever new generation might come online as a result of it. Okay. The steam plant fuel clause adjustment, that last piece, you talked about extended production hours and production days. I mean, presumably if that's costing you more, I mean, are you getting less done while spending more resources? I mean, and is that a result of the additional overburden you addressed? And, I mean, given what little I know about coal mining, I mean, you sort of take the low-hanging fruit first. So if we're getting into heavier and heavier overburden, presumably we're going to see more of the same for that this year and the year after that and the year after that. In what ways am I mistaken in that assumption?
I don't think you are. We are running into a higher overburden strip right now, and they are going to be higher costs, and that is why we're running more shifts and more people, basically. We're also had to ramp up for YGEN 2 that was placed in service January 1 of 2008, and they are subscribed to a statement R methodology pricing as well. And then also with YGEN 3 coming online in 2010, that will have additional coal that needs to be produced out of that mine. So hopefully as we maybe spread these costs a little bit more, it won't be quite as big of an impact. But again, I don't see costs decreasing from where we're at this point with the steam plant.
So this is sort of another unfair IRP type question. So, you know, punt if you want. But, I mean, given that we're already getting into higher and higher overburden and YGEN 2 just came on and YGEN 3 will be coming on, I mean, how long is this sustainable? I mean, at some point, does higher and higher overburden and higher production cost, does that begin to make this type of fuel not cost competitive? I mean, probably not. I guess running your CTs is pretty gosh darn expensive.
I believe our coal plants are significantly less
expensive than any other alternative out there. And one of the things with the coal mine is you kind of start and you work through a given area. I mean, you do pick the low-hanging fruit, but you kind of start and work through. So right now we are in a deep area, but as you move through that, you know, there's not necessarily no light at the end of the tunnel. But I guess we see for the next couple of years kind of being in the same position as far as the overburden in the coal mine that we have. Certainly, fuel prices have mitigated somewhat in that respect. And as we do look towards bringing Wygen 3 online, you know, some of the fixed costs of the mine do get spread out then amongst a bigger pool of generating resources, so that should help also.
Okay. So with regard to that analysis about, well, you know, geez, the coal plants are still a lot cheaper than CTs or market power, I mean, I mean, Black Hills Power must have done some sort of analysis of the resources that still exist geographically in that area. I mean, are we talking about a decade, four decades, or 200 years? I mean,
I think we talk about 50 years of reserves.
Okay.
Given what our expansion is looking like. Well beyond the life of the plants that we have there right now.
It's not impossible, but highly unlikely that I guess I'll be sitting here in 50 years, but still worthwhile to be asking the questions. So, okay, other questions from commissioners or advisors? Okay. Any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman, I will move that the commission approve the electric cost adjustment effective March 1st.
A motion has been made, and no second is required. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Say, Mr. Chairman, we did look at the total increase of the revenue is about 4.2%. So,
which is indeed between 4 and 4.5. So.
Right, great.
Thank you very much for joining. Appreciate it.
It's always better to be able to do a clarification rather than a correction, you know. So, all right. Well, we apologize to Quest and Mr. Hall for taking time on those dockets, but we do come to consumer complaint, item number one. That does deal with Mr. Hall and Quest. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission grant the motion for summary disposition of complaint that was made by Quest? Additionally, you know, Mr. Hall had some sort of a motion to compel in his response. I mean, I'm not making a ruling on this. I just... Because we didn't notice it, it seems as though it would be difficult for us to take that up today. But at some point, if we need to address that, we certainly can. But certainly, we'll take up first this the commission, rather the Quest motion to for summary disposition. Quest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, commissioners. I'm George Thompson. I'm a corporate counsel with Quest Corporation, and I'm here today to represent the company with regard to Mr. Hall's complaint. And as the commissioners know, we have made a motion for summary disposition of this complaint. And when I was reviewing the notice for today's meeting, I realized that...
Mr. Thompson?
Yes, sir.
You're doing fine, but before you get warmed up, I just want to remind everybody that we do have a court reporter here in Pierre, and she is... you know, trying to follow us the best she can. So because we've got Mr. Hall and Mr. Thompson on the phone, let's do what we can to speak clearly and identify ourselves. And, again, you were doing fine, George, but I just, before you got warmed up, wanted to remind you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. Go ahead.
And as part of our review of the notice, we saw that the commission intends to examine a variety of things, including the pleadings, any depositions, our answers to the interrogatories propounded by Mr. Hall, and any admissions in any of those documents. And then there was a mention of affidavits, and we realized that in an abundance of caution, we probably ought to ask Dan Kaiser, who's present today in the audience, to step to the stand for about 3 or 4 minutes worth of questions under oath to verify some of the facts that have been stated in our pleadings. So with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Dan Kaiser to come up in front of the commission at this point.
Yeah, let's just pause on that for a moment, Mr. Thompson. I want to you know, get some quick analysis from our general counsel as to what the appropriate course of action here is. Mr. Smith?
Well, you know, George, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here. I mean, the way the motion was phrased, and, you know, I think we have one course of action to resolve a case as a motion for summary judgment. And I think when we cross the line over to live testimony with cross-examination, et cetera, I think then we're moving on to hearing, aren't we?
Well, Mr. Smith, I would agree if this examination wasn't limited to verifying the facts stated in our motion. We don't intend here to ask Mr. Kaiser to testify as if he were at a dispositive hearing on all aspects of this case. We just like him to verify the facts that are stated in the pleadings. And so, I think that's consistent with the statute at 1-26-18 that outlines the procedural rights of the parties under South Dakota law.
This is Commissioner Johnson. So, Mr. Smith, I mean, being a legal, you know, layperson, I mean, lay this out for me. I mean, should there have been some notice to Mr. Hall? Does he have an opportunity to cross-examine? I mean, again, this isn't a hearing, so what does this look and feel like from Mr. Hall's perspective? And I should make a clear mask to Mr. Smith, but certainly a staff counsel has, or Mr. Hall have, you know, comments or legal analysis to contribute. I'm all ears as well.
Well, again, maybe we should hear what Mr. Hall's position is. I guess he's the other party, and hear what he has to say. Again, I think I comprehend the distinction you're making, Mr. Thompson, which is I think. That all you're asking him to do is all you're asking him to do just fill in a technical gap and in effect, you know, what would be the same as filing a one paragraph objection and stating that I state under oath that the things that are contained in my exhibit are true.
Mr. Smith, that's absolutely correct. I mean, what we're trying to do is ask the commission to recognize that the facts as stated in our pleadings are accurate to the knowledge of a witness who works in the area and is knowledgeable of Mr. Hall's complaint.
Okay, and I maybe would look to Mr. Hall. Did you have a position?
I guess, thank you, Mr. Smith, and first thing, thank you for letting me call in today. I appreciate it. I'm pretty booked out this end. I do have another time commitment, about 35 minutes. You know, I guess I'm not prepared, and I don't know what Mr. Kaiser is going to provide to the commission, and I'm not really prepared to address that at this time. You know, I've got the complaint in front of me. I mean, if there's something specific we want to talk about, I guess I can prepare to talk about that, but like I say, I'm not prepared to cross-examine speak, and I think you're crossing the line here when you ask him to come up and validate facts. You know, I guess that's my opinion. I'm not prepared to discuss this in that kind of depth today.
Staff counsel, any thoughts?
I don't have any opposition to a live affidavit of sorts, so long as there's a verification of the facts as they're written. You know, in an affidavit, there is no cross-examination. It's just an under oath statement that the facts are true. So long as that's the case, I don't believe there would be any prejudice to Mr. Hall.
Again, a legal layperson. So in a typical live affidavit scenario, I mean, does someone have an opportunity to challenge the witness on something they say? I mean, is there a cross-examination? Is there a testing of that evidence, so to speak?
No, I don't believe, first, it's typical to do a live affidavit, but no cross-examination. It would simply be the engineer who made these quotes to say, yes, those are the correct numbers. Nothing more than that, just as an example.
because if they're not, just so I can make sure I understand, because if they're not bringing any new information up, all of the information they're talking about already would have been in the filings. There would have been an opportunity to go through discovery to verify or challenge those numbers. And so no one's really being prejudiced through that. Am I getting that all right?
I agree with your statement.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Roger Hall. So as long as it's a statement of fact, I guess, and that's not opinion.
Yeah, and I, you know.
I'm a lay person too, Commissioner Johnson. I mean.
Well, I've looked at your filings. Maybe you're a little bit less lay than I am.
I had the copy. There's a lot of copying.
Well, and I do think if Mr. Thompson's allowed to do this, then, you know, if there's something you hear that's objectionable, you know, we'll certainly want to hear that.
Okay.
At some point, Mr. Hall. Mr. Smith, Ms. Wiest, anyone else, any thoughts, analysis?
Well, again, it'd be nice to know exactly what you're talking about. Maybe we can hear where you're going to go with it, Mr. Thompson. And I guess my feeling is if we go, and again, my gut feeling here is that the commissioners and maybe myself may have some questions of people too. I mean, that's the other oddity of this thing that we're going to want to delve into. But, you know, I sort of just think out of fairness, either, you know, if we're going the direction of hearing, we go hearing. And I guess my thought is if all it's going to be is just verifying, if you're just going to state under oath, And provide that level of, you know, in effect, replacement for just a very summary affidavit, which doesn't add any substance. I think it's fair. But I don't think, in terms of offering it as documentary evidence that was presented, to the complainant and the commission prior to the hearing, I don't think that's, appropriate, because then we've crossed the line over to hearing, I think.
Well, Mr. Smith, can I address some basic things in the motion for summary disposition? This is Roger. I mean, I don't dispute the prices that were provided. I think those are the ones that they were provided to me by Mr. Kaiser. He said Mr. Hall rejected all options. I guess I'd say I didn't accept them. That's just in semantics. I mean, if there's other information than that that's in question, I guess we can discuss it.
Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Thompson again. Maybe I can cut to the chase by just making a short offer of proof as to what Mr. Kaiser is going to testify to, and that way the commission will have a little more information in front of them to make their decision on the question we've raised. Actually, I intend to ask Mr. Kaiser what his position at Quest is, how long he's worked at Quest, if he's got personal knowledge of the facts around Mr. Hall's complaint, if he reviewed the motion for summary disposition and the interrogatory answers that Quest filed in this case, and if those, if his review revealed that those facts were indeed accurate. And that's about the extent of the examination I'd like to put on today.
Well, we didn't appoint a hearing officer, so I guess I'm it, so I'll render a preliminary judgment, and certainly it can be challenged by my colleagues. But I would say that you can proceed, Mr. Thompson, with that at that narrow scope.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll call Mr. Kaiser to the stand, please.
Mr. Kaiser, we'd ask you to, you know, make sure you pull the mic close. You'll need to be sworn in.
I have a big mouth, Commissioner.
So. Okay, good.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Good afternoon, Mr. Kaiser. What's your position at Quest?
I'm the design engineering manager for South Dakota, North Dakota, Western Minnesota, and Northern Nebraska.
How long have you worked at Quest or its predecessor companies?
34 years.
And have you been personally involved in the engineering and attempts to resolve Mr. Hall's complaint?
Yes, since June of 2007, I've worked directly with two of my subordinates, Ian Trump and Sue Cotton, to educate Mr. Hall on the requirements of the Quest Exchange Network Service Catalog number 1 with regard to mobile home park construction.
Mr. Kaiser, did you review the motion for summary disposition and the interrogatory answers that Quest filed in this case and provided to Mr. Hall as well as the other parties in the commission?
Yes.
Were the facts contained in those interrogatory answers and the motion for summary disposition accurate as far as you know?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, that ends my examination, and I'll be happy to tender Mr. Kaiser to answer any questions that the commissioners, Mr. Hall, or anyone else that's interested in discussing these things that Mr. Kaiser has.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Thompson, I think maybe that's not a good idea. You know, we just, at this point, this isn't a hearing. I mean, I had a lot of questions I want to ask him. I'm just not sure, absent a hearing, if this is the right, if we should allow that to happen. Any thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're saying, and I'll accede to that. And if you'd like, I'll be happy to go straight to argument here, and then Mr. Hall can present his arguments, and the commission can take those under advisement and do what them what they will.
Okay. Does anybody have a problem proceeding right to argument for Mr. Thompson? Okay. Mr. Kaiser, you can step down. Mr. Thompson, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to review everything that we've pled in our motion that's being considered here today, but I do want to mention a few salient facts. And the first one is that Mr. Hall owns a mobile home park in Hill City and is in the process of expanding it. And another salient fact here today is that Quest has facilities that can be extended to serve some new trailers that have been installed in the mobile home park and perhaps other trailers that Mr. Hall intends to serve in the future as well. Quest has sent Mr. Hall 2 quotes for construction of extended facilities that are described in this motion. And as Mr. Hall says, he hasn't responded to those quotes. And finally, Quest Exchange and Network Services Catalog number 1 has a specific provision that applies to construction of Quest facilities into mobile home parks. The appropriate portions of the catalog have been recorded in our pleading, and I'm not going to read them here. But I will say that the 2 catalog sections that are mentioned in the pleading provide ample authority for the company to request a contribution to the construction costs from Mr. Hall. Mr. Hall has argued that he's entitled to receive all the required construction at the company's expense, but to date, I haven't seen anything that Mr. Hall has provided in the form of a pleading that would constitute a legal basis underlying that claim. So Quest's position here is that Mr. Hall is, in essence, asking the commission to discriminate in his favor by allowing him to avoid paying construction costs that would be charged to any similarly situated customer who happened to own a mobile home park that was in the Quest service territory in South Dakota. We believe that Mr. Hall's attempt to circumvent his responsibilities to pay his portion of the construction charges by arguing that somehow the general goals of universal service trump the filed rate doctrine is an erroneous argument. And he hasn't provided any case law, statute, or commission rule to support that position either. So, in sum, we ask the commission to grant our motion to dismiss this complaint because there is no other appropriate legal course to follow here. And I believe that the salient material facts are undisputed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Hall, your argument.
All right. Thank you. Well, and as we pointed out before, I'm a layperson, and thank you again for letting me do this. You know, it seems like we went through the same discussion during our motion to dismiss a few months ago. You know, my fundamental thing is, and I'll cut to the chase here very quickly because I think we're all time constrained. I know I am. I got to go somewhere else here.
Excuse me, Mr. Hall.
Yes.
This is a court reporter. Can I ask you to just slow down a little bit?
Okay.
Thank you.
That's all right. I speak fast. I did it in front of you guys last time.
Okay. You said, you know, my fundamental, and then I lost.
My fundamental crux of this whole thing is I'm willing to pay for the improvements on my property. All right? I have never disagreed with that. What I've disagreed with is when they came out and said I had to pay for improvements back into town to upgrade their system in order to handle my development. However, I feel they have failed to follow the law, and I can't state it. You know, it's 2011-33-13, if I read my scribbles, where they are supposed to employ prudent and planning practices. Furthermore, they have failed to answer any of my interrogatories and provide a cost-benefit analysis. I am providing them 9 or more homes in an area where you would only have 2 homes, maybe. So it seems like it would be a benefit to them to have more customers. Back to my discussion. Hill City continues to grow at 6% per year, and that's a steady growth rate. That can be validated by the Hill City Economic Development Commission. Somewhere during this game, they have changed their definition of campus environment to include mobile home courts. When we started this, as Dan said, back in June of 2007, mobile home courts were not included in that definition. So it's been kind of subtle through the thing.
Excuse me.
It did make me an offer.
Excuse me, Mr. Hall?
Yes.
This is a court reporter again.
Yes.
You're just breaking up a little bit.
Okay, hold on. Let me see if I can improve it. Okay, is that better?
I think so. The last sentence I have, when we started this, as Dan said, back in June of 2007, mobile home courts were not included in that definition.
Right. They had – you got that? I'm getting an echo now. Anyway, they it said campus environment. It did not include mobile home courts. However, I also have to add in here that in Hill City, Quest is a monopoly. I have no other choice of provider. That's why I say I am willing to pay for the improvement on my property. Twice I have had the trench open for them to install the wire or for me to install the wire that they would provide and provide it for these new homes. If you look closely at the offer they made, the only word they changed in the whole offer, even through negotiations, was they added the words not to exceed. And I was still paying for all the wire and a lot of the other improvements. So I got to turn my page here. Hold on. You know, like I say, I have incurred cost already. I've opened the ditch twice and filled it twice. You know, I've got 20 tons of sand stockpiled for the bedding material. It should be, I skipped down. I already said that. I guess my other question is, if I pay for these improvements, you know, if I was to go ahead and say, okay, I'll pay for these improvements, and all of a sudden 6 houses build up beside me and take all of my capacity, do I have to pay when I add on again? There would be my big question. Once again, back to prudency. Quest did not answer any of the interrogatories. They just basically put the same boilerplate through 24 questions, and the only information they provided that was information that I had already provided them. My request is simple. You know, I'm trying to get service to my tenants. I will provide the trench and generally agree to all these access terms that are in the motion for summary judgment in there. I don't have a problem with any of those. But on the other hand, I'm not real willing to upgrade their system back in town. I think we need to go to a hearing so we can get all the facts on the table and clearly present just what the facts are and show where we're at and what we can do. Now, this has gone on long enough. It's June 2007, and here we are going into 2009. So, and that's about all I got to say. I'd like this to go to a hearing so we can hear the facts of the case. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Hall. Staff?
Mr. Chairman, this is Kara Semler for staff. I believe the facts, as we have them, do show Mr. Hall is responsible for the trenching. I believe the facts, as we have them, do show it is for trenching and it's not for other upgrades. As I believe Mr. Hall maybe stated, the conversations he had with Quest engineers do date back to June of 07. And in those conversations, the facts as staff understands it, there were four trailers that were not being served by Quest that Mr. Hall wanted to be served by Quest. And he does reference those facts in his original complaint, 17 out of, I don't remember what it was, but anyway, four trailers we're dealing with. Mr. Hall was quoted the trenching price for those line extensions to those four trailers. So I believe that's what we're dealing with here, and that's the facts as we're pled, and that's the issue as it stands. And I do disagree with Mr. Hall that it should be at Quest's expense to extend lines to those four trailers. So to repeat, staff believes that it should be at Mr. Hall's expense, and we recommend dismissing this. I believe the
This is Roger Hall, and I don't disagree that. Sorry to interrupt, but you know I'm willing to extend the money on my property. That I'm willing to do.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Hall. Before we take questions, we'll look toward Mr. Thompson. Do you have any rebuttal?
Mr. Chairman, the only rebuttal I'd have to what Mr. Hall said is that I would ask the commissioners to look at a copy of the Quest Corporation Exchange and Network Services Catalog Number 1. I don't know if the commissioners have access to that, but I do know that Ms. Siebold has copies of both Section 4.7, which address mobile homes, and Section 4.2, which are the general terms and conditions for construction charges.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Thompson. Commissioner Advisor, questions? Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes. Mr. Hall, the amount that you came up with was if the trenching was done, it was $2,400, correct?
Well, that's hard to read, Commissioner Colbeck. I apologize. It was not to exceed $2,400 plus wire and trenching.
Okay.
The $2,400 was to splice in back in their system 2,900 feet back towards the switch. That's what the $2,400 was, my understanding.
And you're saying that $2,400 is their improvements? I guess you lost me there.
Well, they're saying, you know, 2,900 feet from my property is where they have to go back. The switch is only about 3,000 feet away, and they have to go back towards the switch and improve their system in order for this end of town, the southeast corner of town, to have capacity to handle these additional units. And like I said before, I said I'm willing to pay for my on-property improvements. That I'm willing to do. I'm not sure, you know, because if somebody else builds around me and takes up that capacity, I mean, why should I be stuck with the whole bill for improving their system?
And Mr. Thompson?
Yes, sir.
Is that the way you understand it, that this $2,400 is for system upgrades in your system or just for the splicing?
No, sir, Mr. Commissioner. I believe the $2,400 is primarily for the splicing into existing cable and to provide, if you will, adequate distribution facilities into the mobile home park.
Which you're probably talking about protectors and other things like that. Not the cable? You're not talking about the cable because Mr. Hall said he would supply that, correct?
No. That's correct. The cable, the DMARC or the network interface device, which would be the separation point. Mr. Hall would have to place the post for that network interface device and then run the cable from that device to each of the units that he wants to serve inside of the park.
Okay.
Can I interject? This is Roger.
Go ahead.
I guess, Commissioner Colbeck, my question comes down to definitions, and this is where we probably need clarity and get into some more depth, and this is why I want to go to a hearing. If I read the Quest telephone directory correctly, the MPOP is on the outside of the house, and typically Quest is responsible for bearing to the MPOP. Like I said, once again, I'm prepared to front the cost for the trenching. I'm just not seeing why I need to upgrade their system. So, and as far as the post and everything like that, I'm not sure what – I don't have a good handle on what the total cost is.
I guess I was under the understanding that the MPOP would be the pad and the NID would be on the house. I guess that's – maybe that's where everyone's confused. As to where – I guess I'm confused as to what the $2,400 entails. I guess I want to know what Mr. Hall would be paying for the $2,400. I guess so. I have a question. Does that lead us to hearing, Mr. Smith?
Well, I think if we're going to delve into factual testimony, yes, it does. You know, I think if Mr. Thompson can address that, but you know, we're not noticed for hearing today. This is just a motion, so.
So in a way, without getting the breakdown of costs, I mean, I'm curious about that too, Commissioner Colbeck. I mean, is it – big picture question, Mr. Thompson, is it Quest's contention that sufficient capacity exists near the new housing units to serve those customers?
Mr. Chairman, I think Quest's position is that there needs to be splicing done into existing cable in order to exploit existing capacity and bring service for the additional units that Mr. Hall wants to serve into the mobile home park.
Okay, so after, you know, Mr. Thompson, Mr. Smith, and Ms. Semler, I mean, again, if this question goes too far, just tell me. Will that splicing be sufficient just to serve those new customers, or will that create some additional capacity for future customers?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Thompson again. It's my understanding that this splicing is specifically to serve Mr. Hall's tenants.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah, Commissioner Colbeck.
Mr. Thompson, is there any charges of any splicing other than in the pad in front of Mr. Hall's property that he's being charged for?
No, Mr. Commissioner. We would run the additional splice cable into a point where the NID would exist from the existing MPOP.
This is Roger Hall. That's somewhere in this volume of documents. That's not what that said. I think it said it was 2,000 feet away. Somewhere in here it said the splicing would have to occur 2,000 feet away from my property. I can't put my fingers on it right now as I go through this. So.
Well, and so the first pad where the drops come out of that would feed your property are 2,000 feet away. Is that correct?
Pardon me? No, there's a pad on the corner of my property. And my discussion point is that they keep saying from the beginning of this process, they said they have to upgrade the system, and they started by saying back into town. Well, I'm in town, but the switch is 3,000 feet away. And somewhere in here, it talks about distances where it says the first upgrade would be like 1,400 feet, and if there was more capacity required, it would be like 2,900 feet. That's in the testimony that somebody provided here in this documentation.
So, you know, Mr. Thompson, in your Quest Corporation's answer and motion to dismiss that was filed some number of months ago, you make note of 4.3 construction charges, that section, which you don't mention in your most recent filing, but you do mention it in that motion to dismiss. And the catalog wording there says the customer will be provided the first 400 feet beyond the nearest point of capacity at no charge. That whole section deals with construction charges. So if the pad, I mean, if everybody admits that the pad is right there, close by, within 400 feet of where the new residences would be, how does 4.3 not come into play?
Mr. Commissioner, 4.3 applies to individual homeowners, and that line extension policy is for someone who constructs a new house or buys a house that does not presently have telecom facilities and wishes to have, as an individual customer, facilities extended to that home. Section 4.7, however, applies specifically to cluster and mobile homes. And so it's really the reference in the catalog that applies to Mr. Hall's situation. Mr. Hall is the owner of the park and rents trailers to a variety of tenants who live in the park. But he is not sold, as I understand it, the trailers or the pads to individuals. And so he's got the same responsibility as any other developer of a mobile home park would have. And those responsibilities are set out at Section 4.7 of the catalog.
So, and this is just me being dense, but if 4.3 doesn't apply to this situation, why did you cite it in your motion to dismiss?
Mr. Chairman, I have to get with Mr. Topp about why that was cited, but I think that was cited in error, frankly.
Okay. Other questions?
Commissioner, I'd like to make an observation, correct a misstatement that I've been listening to as people have been discussing this. Excuse me. The whole idea behind customer charge policy is not so either the customer Quest pays it. The whole idea behind these customer extension policies is so other customers won't have to pay it. And that's the proper way to look at this. Either Mr. Hall will pay for it or the other customers on the system will pay for it. So really you're balancing whether or not this cost should be socialized or should it apply to that single customer. I just want to correct that notion.
Commissioner Colbeck.
Well, and I guess my confusion doesn't lie in that. My confusion lies on how they come up with the charges, whether those charges would be appropriate to just bury from a trailer house to a pad in front of your house $2,000, or if it actually doesn't. Because as soon as it goes into the main line, your feeder cable, doesn't it switch over to Quest responsibility, or am I?
Well, I think, this is Greg Ristlip again, that's really a fact-based thing. Not necessarily. I mean, these situations, unless it's very clear in the tariff to whom it should apply, to apply the tariff, one may have to look at the facts of the situation. And in this case, we have Quest saying that it's Splice and it only applies to this particular customer. Sure. And that's the only facts I have to go on. But I really wasn't even addressing that, and I wasn't really addressing what you were saying. I just wanted to point out that, the whole idea behind the policies that we've approved over time is to whether or not these costs should be socialized to the system or whether they apply to a specific customer. And that was my only point.
Well, would it be appropriate then if Quest ran a line out to the first trailer and they absorbed whatever costs because that was the first person? Now in an expansion, because Mr. Hall is basically a developer.
Right.
He's basically going to add houses or trailer houses or whatever. Is it in accordance with the law for Mr. Hall to have to pay for capacity expansion plus drops?
If you look at the various utilities, and Quest is relatively narrow here as far as telecom utility, but if you look at the electric utilities, for instance, even out in the Black Hills, when there's an incremental expansion for a development, and say just one house where there may be a possibility of 10 houses, normally that cost does focus on that first customer, and then over time, if other people move in, some of that can be refunded based on tariff. But it may not be. You know, once a certain passage of time has gone on, the time value of money, whatever, the bulk of that cost will stay with that original customer. You know, and again, this is something that we've been looking at over the 30 years I've been here, and you can go through and show why that cost has to be assigned that way, which we certainly haven't done to this extent now, but that would be costs that allow for expansion. I don't know if that's been shown today that anything done here is allowing for expansion other than within the trailer court. I don't know.
So, Mr. Thompson, this is Commissioner Johnson again. I'm looking at, you know, in your pleading here, 4.2 and then Section 2, and it says, where the facilities required to provide a requested service are not available, and in the opinion of the company, the cost to provision service to a customer does not constitute a prudent investment, the customer may be required to pay. And then it lists a few different options, including agreeing to a longer than normal initial service period or any combination thereof. I mean, did Quest give any consideration? Well, I probably can't ask that. Just in a general way, I would say, is this the only approach that makes sense? I mean, as we look toward driving to a possible hearing here, I mean, is it possible that there's some outcome other than just Mr. Hall paying for the totality? I mean, you talk about him being treated the same as similarly situated mobile home park owners, but your catalog does allow for some flexibility in the way that the company would treat a situation like this, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to try to be very careful here and say that, you know, Section 4.2 of the catalog applies in a general way to the situation where facilities are not available. But Section 4.7 applies to the specific construction of facilities into, including others, mobile homes. And particularly where one person owns the mobile home park and the facilities are designed to go in and serve individual tenants in that mobile home park. I would say that the company is constrained by the anti-discrimination statute in the state from treating mobile home park owners in a way different than the company has treated Mr. Hall.
Mr. Hall, so you know, Ms. Siebold is offering to provide copies of the catalog to anyone who wants it. Certainly anybody, you know, let the Colleen know if you need something. So, Mr. Thompson, Commissioner Johnson, again, specifically, what part of 4.7 would explicitly, you know, make it clear that 4.2.2 wouldn't apply? I mean, one wonders if the company maybe has more flexibility in its catalog here than is being argued.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pausing here to read through very carefully Section 4.7, so if you'll bear with me for a moment.
Sure, go ahead. Take the time you need.
Hey, Mr. Hall, I have a question for you while we wait here.
Yes, sir.
Were you satisfied with the initial charges that it took to get your first? I guess how many trailer houses did you put on your property to begin with? Just one?
Well, actually, the trailer park started in 1983 with my father.
Okay.
And so it kind of predates any of this.
Okay.
I'll tell you right now, I have two houses up there,
okay,
and I have 17 homes, or 17 mobile homes, I should say, that are currently being served. I have since added 9, and I'll admit I have requests for 2 more right now, and I'm holding up because of this issue. Once again, I can't put my fingers on it right now, and to be honest, my time is running short.
All right, thank you.
I'll find the document that says that their improvements were back into their system. That's the key one to me.
You obviously didn't start with 2 homes and 17 mobile homes. As these were expanded, did you pay for the expansions of those?
No, my father did not. He loved beer, but he's in Yuma. Initially, the one house has been there over 100 years, but the 17 mobile homes were put in, and there was no charge for the expansion into those mobile homes. At that time, Quest, or I'm sure AT&T or whoever at the time, Ma Bell, whatever, put in the PEDs to each mobile home sequentially. We started with 5, and then we added 5 more, and then we added 1, and then we added whatever the balance is there. I don't recall.
Okay.
My father. So.
That probably predates our existing statute, though. So
It does. It does. I will say that. And as I said before, my property is ringed by Quest. I've counted there are up to 47 available home sites at that end of town. So that's my concern with upgrading the system and me not having the capacity to do what I want to do, or upgrading a system and then using it up and have to do it again later.
All right. Thank you.
And Commissioner Johnson, this is Mr. Thompson again to answer your question. I would point to Section 4.7E6 as the closest situation to what we've got right now in the record.
Okay. So, Mr. Thompson, I mean, given that, Mr. Hall has alleged that there are 47, development properties, in that southeastern part of town, and given the fact that he, cites 20, 10, 33, 13, which says that each local exchange company shall employ prudent management planning practices, including budgeting and prioritization of resource utilization, so that adequate and reliable facilities are in place to supply service to prospective customers. I mean, I'll give you an opportunity to respond to Mr. Hall's argument that is, given the build-out in that area, Quest should be on its own dime working to build out those facilities so it can serve prospective customers and take advantage of that revenue stream. Response?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that I don't take issue with the statute or the particular duty of the company, but timing is an issue under that umbrella. And I don't think it's the company's I don't believe it would be prudent for the company to place excess capacity significantly ahead of actual shovels in the ground type development activities going on in any real estate that's surrounded a populated area in the state. What Mr. Hall is asking the commission to do is support an interpretation of the catalog in the statute, which would say that Quest has a duty to extend its facilities to any place that there is speculation about future development upon. I mean, Mr. Hall states there are 47 parcels. We don't know. Have those parcels been platted? Has the developer attempted to begin development of those parcels? And, the company's duties are clear, but the duties can be fulfilled and adequate and reliable service can be provided at a time when there are knowns. I mean, the company has a responsibility to be prudent not only to the citizens of the state, but also to its internal stakeholders and its shareholders, and conserve its capital expenditures and put them where they need to be at the moment in time where service is required. And service is not required to undeveloped land that may be the subject of future development.
Mr. Thompson, Commissioner Johnson again, and I understand the problems with, you know, Mr. Hall's interpretation of all of this different language, but, you know, you noted it wouldn't be prudent for Quest to build out ahead of development. You know, given the way that Quest is asking the commission to interpret all of this language, it really wouldn't be prudent because, you know, Quest could always assign the costs of that build out to people who need the service. I mean, would there ever be a scenario under that landscape where Quest would plan ahead and build out on its own dime?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would require a significant amount of development to have taken place prior to the time that the company would put its facilities in. I mean, the company would generally put its facilities into a new subdivision, for instance, at the point in time where the developer notifies the company and other utilities that would be providing facilities there. And, you know, at that point in time where platting has happened, perhaps construction is beginning, facilities are made available to the company after notice to the company and other utilities. You know, those sorts of things aren't happening with the plots that Mr. Hall is referring to. So I would say that, no, I don't think the company can avoid its responsibilities to provide adequate service to potential customers. But I believe that potential customers needs to be interpreted in a way that doesn't expend the company's scarce resources unnecessarily.
Sure. Other commissioner questions? Advisor questions? Okay, I'll move to questions, comments, or action. Yeah, I just by way of comment, you know, I think the difficulty that we get into is when you just look at these maps and you see all of these different, you know, residences, and then you see, you know, four lines in a map that are so close, you know, next to or just across the road, and it's, you know, $2,400 if all of the trenching is done and $2,400 just for splicing. And maybe that's true. I mean, maybe I'm sure that's reasonable and I'm sure that's a legitimate, estimation of costs. The problem I'm coming to, the discomfort I've got, is when I go and get an oil change, the bill has more detail than I feel like we've got here before us. It's just, it's tough to take all of this language, which talks about reasonable and prudent, and try to determine. I mean, I can imagine plenty of fact, or maybe not plenty, but at least some fact sets in a scenario like this where, you know, I'm not sure I'd think Mr. Hall was so wrong. Now, I don't know what the facts will say about this, but I'm just not sure that I've got the information in front of me right now to feel completely comfortable that there aren't any, you know, material facts, you know, facts that really matter to us that are in dispute. Other commissioner comments or?
Is there any way, without going to a full-blown hearing, that we can get an itemized bill on what these entail? Or do we have to go to a full hearing?
Well, I'm sorry, this is Roger. I didn't hear the question.
Oh, I was just asking if there was any way, without going to a full-blown hearing, if we can find out what there were three different options given, what each one of those entails.
You know, I think and this is John Smith here, and I apologize but for butting in maybe, but, you know, the problem is the documentation that we have now, and a motion for summary judgment, you got to base it just on the documentation, right? And I think the problem really is that, at least for me looking at it, is it just doesn't answer those questions. You know, it doesn't answer, really, what exactly are these charges for? And that's the problem, I think, is that I think the problem that a couple of you guys have raised in Mr. Hall is, are some of these charges for facilities for people other than Mr. Hall? All the buildings I see on that are his trailer park, you know, but, you know, I just don't know if, I don't think we have anything in the record that I see that tells us exactly what those charges are for, you know. The word splicing is used, but it doesn't, we don't know where the splicing is occurring and what those costs really are covering, you know, that I can see, unless you guys correct me if I'm wrong.
No, but the motion for summary disposition, of that, from my understanding, if there are any questions, you have to go to hearing.
If there's a question of material fact.
Of material fact, that's right.
If there's a question of material fact, if you feel it isn't material, you wouldn't have to go to hearing. But and that the movement quest in this case is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. But if you feel there's a question involving a material issue of fact, then we have to go to hearing. I mean, I think what you could, you know, if you felt the situation admitted of it, you could probably grant the motion in part. You know, I guess I don't know right now. Maybe it's because we've had such a terribly long day here. I don't know that I'm smart enough to figure out how to phrase something like that. And
maybe we can get you some right nicotine gum quick and snap you back in it.
Well, you know, and to add, you know, Commissioner Colbeck, I mean, I sort of feel like if we don't feel like the motion for summary judgment, if that burden hasn't been met, then at some point going to a hearing is the right of the parties. I mean, the right of the complainant, and I may think in a more itemized, you know, estimate is what I'm interested in, but at some point there may be lots of other facts and questions that have the right to come, you know, see the light of day, absent someone, you know, proving their case just on the basis of the law. So that would be my thought. I would be a little reticent to only let in, you know, this piece of information or that piece of information.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, when my mother met my father,
on your cell phone, it's 37.
When my mother met my father, he was a combat air pilot and she was a teacher. And they met for 5 minutes and then he flew down to Texas and she was in Vermilion. 6 months later, he sent a letter asking her to marry him without any correspondence in between. She replied by saying, "I do not even know you well enough to say no." I feel like I am in a similar position as my mother. And so for that reason, I am going to make a motion that the commission deny the motion for summary disposition of the complaint.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Discussion on the motion. And I'll just say your mother is a very smart woman. That was, I think that's put very well. Other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
John Smoltz, aye. The motion carries 3-0, meaning that Quest's motion for summary judgment has been denied. With that, we'll proceed toward the procedural schedule toward hearing.
All righty.
Thanks to the parties. With that, I believe we'll just draw your attention to the announcements that appear on the agenda. And unless anyone else has any other business they believe we should be taking up, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you.